You have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
Hey everybody, Jason here, Business Broker Growth Show. I have my new friend, guest on the show, Andrew Maroli. He is the founder, co-founder, and managing partner of BuyAUM. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Jason, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to today's conversation. I hope it's at least somewhat valuable for those listening.
I know it will be. I know it's going to be fun because I am excited for it. I am curious. I want to know a lot more about what you do, how you got here, and what you focus on. Because to me, you're in the M&A business broker space in a very specific niche that's, you know, not the standard ones that everyone hears about. That's, you know, the HVAC or the roofing or, you know, the big money ones that PE always wants to get involved with. So let's talk about your background, the evolution to where you're at now with BuyAUM.
So a lot of this comes down to, as an entrepreneur, you're like kind of an opportunist. And so the end of the story is realizing the total addressable market of financial advisors retiring over the next 10 years, right? And it's like, depending on the stats, it's 40% of all advisors. It's like $10 trillion in the U.S. alone. It's a lot, right? The background, my journey begins in Southern California, unlicensed, unregistered kid, straight out of university. My father was a financial advisor. I said, give me all of the wholesalers that hit you up. I'm going to call them and say, who hires an unlicensed kid? And one of them took the bait, and I moved out to Newport Beach and was wowed when I first went there. I grew up in Atlanta. My father's also an Air Force pilot, so we moved a lot. I get to Southern California, I'm like, this place is sick. You know, why anywhere out there? On my interview, they're like, can you move out here? And I was like, yes. Like, that's the easy part. So my career starts serving financial advisors as an internal and then an external wholesaler of non-traded limited partnerships, REITs, BDCs. I eventually get into oil and gas, which I love that asset class. And so I was a deal guy for a long time in alternatives. And after about 8 years in that, said, you know what, let's kind of take this stab in entrepreneurship. Started a lot of companies. My first company was a tow truck business because I had heard this podcast that a single tow truck can generate like $125,000 a year. And AMI Towing was my first LLC I ever registered. I was an options trader for a long time. I started a newsletter. I did a lot of stuff, right? Eventually, I said, well, let's, you know, my background and skill set is in selling product. Let's open a consulting company. And now, instead of being dictated by a base salary and terms and all of that, now I get to control my destiny and see and choose what I raise capital for. So I was doing that for a couple of years. It was good. There's some good deals, some bad deals, or some good years and bad years, right? I got to pick the deals, which was nice. One day, it's middle of the week, I get a cold call. I answer it. And this guy on the other line says, Andrew, I want to be honest with you. It's a cold call. Do you want to hang up or let me have 30 seconds? I was like, straight line. Go for it. Long story short, that ends up being my co-founder in BuyAUM. And we spoke for probably an hour. We're both in the business. We're both cold callers. We connect on a monthly basis to talk about life and family and business. And eventually together we said, you know, what's out there that we could start a business around? And he's like, I'm excellent at cold calling. I'm like, great. You can build a business around that. My father had just gone through a transition of his RIA practice, and it took 18 months. He was one of five partners. They had about $500 million in AUM, and it almost ripped their partnership apart. One of the five partners said, screw you guys. I'm not a part of this. It took 18 months. Like, it was so, so stressful. And then we, again, back to the kind of the genesis point, we saw the TAM of the amount of AUM of advisors in the U.S. that are going to be retiring over the next decade
how's it currently done? Well, it's currently done in a marketplace that is super impersonable. It's all about numbers and blah, blah, blah. And so we said, how do we flip that around and make it more of a structured kind of dating process, right? And so if I'm in an elevator and someone says, you know, Andrew, what do you do? I say, I'm a matchmaker for financial advisors. I'm a Yenta, right? At the end of the day. And so we've built BuyAUM very slowly but intentionally to take it from this marketplace to a person-to-person connection. And we've had tremendous success. There's a huge appetite from both a buy side and a sell side for a new environment to find a successor that's not this marketplace model.
Yeah. I love it. There's so much in there. And because it's my show, we will go on lots of tangents just based on that. And then we'll pick it up where you left it. I love the fact that you listened to a podcast or ingested some info and said, oh, a tow truck could make 125K a year. So let me start a tow truck company. And all I need is 10 of those. I'm guessing the logic in your head was if I just had 10 tow trucks, like after expenses, like this is great. And I can just sit back. And so that's awesome. It's that, you know, if you ever read, Michael Gerber's E-Myth Revisited, it's that entrepreneurial spasm, mixed with podcast guru, excitement content, right?
And I can only ones that don't work are usually the ones that teach you the most. So,
so I love that. And then let's go to the cold call thing. Cause when you and I had our conversations before, you mentioned that, and I shared that that's actually one of my favorite cold calling strategies. And this is going to be a tangent for anyone listening. We're going to go on a kind of a sales tangent right for a moment. But you had said that your now partner had cold called you and said, hey, if you just give me 30 seconds, hey, this is a cold call. And, you know, the reason why I love that just in sales is that everyone knows it's a cold call. And when you call it like it is, then you're acknowledging it and let's just be upfront and talk about it. And then let's create, you know, what's called the upfront contract, which is if you give me 30 seconds, we'll see if it's worth talking more. And then if it's not, no harm done, right? And it's agreeing to that short window of time, which I love. And if you want a real pattern erupt, I always love odd numbers like 53 seconds, 47 seconds. The key is you've got to actually stick to that number. But like from your side, it obviously resonated. It shocked you because you're like, wait a second, this guy's calling it like it is.
Immediately, I was like, I got to use that. That's such a good line. And the reality is, I think in sales, some people are like, there are salesmen and there are not. And a lot of times it's this intimidating factor to sit down and pick up the phone. The reality is that you have every right to call anyone with a number and they have an equal right to say, I don't want to talk to you. Right. Like that's the world that we live in. So, I think the pattern interrupt is huge. I've also heard another one that's like, you know, Jason, if this was a cold call about selling your business, would you just be like would that completely ruin your day? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, all right, well, then I'm not going to tell you that that's what this is, right? Like it's the cheekiness that's human, right? Hey, this is Andrew from BuyAUM and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, right? But if we can just say, hey, I'm a human, you're a human, I have every right to call you, but you also have every right to hang up on me. Do you want to hang up on me? It's like, I don't know. What are you calling about, right?
Yeah. Let you know, and the basis of this, especially as someone who wasn't raised in sales, and I've written about it in the past, anyone who knows my background knows that history for me. But you know, if you're not a purebred salesperson, pure salesperson that just loves being punched in the face over and over again with rejection and confrontation, you don't want to make those calls. But if you have something valuable to offer that you know will improve somebody else's situation or life, you actually owe it to them. Like it's your responsibility to do it. Like otherwise you're letting them down without even knowing it. But those calls are great because the alternative is, hey, Andrew, this is Jason. How are you today? Hey, oh, so I was looking up on your website and you have such a great business. And I found that you're like, oh, and then you went to this college and that's great. And it's like, just dude, it's a cold call. Just like, you know, the other person's defenses are up because they know something's coming. Instead, just call it like it is. Hey, if I can help you, you know, give me 47 seconds. If this is something that makes sense, if I can help you in any way, then we can keep talking. Otherwise, that's it. And you can hang up on me. Okay. Sounds fair, right? And you know, what's fascinating and fun about that, Andrew, kind of like your example of, you know, hey, if we were to talk about selling your business, would that like totally offend you? Is that if somebody says, no, I won't give you the 30 seconds or the 47 seconds, like, it's okay too. That's okay, because they are obviously not interested or open-minded enough. And there's 8 billion people on the planet. Just call another person.
I think it too, it saves the punch in the face.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not trying to get through my script and you hang up on me and you're like, oh, brutal, another one. Or someone goes, you know, screw you, Denver. It's like, no. And you're like, okay, on to the next one. So for our sales team, I think it helps them stay in the fighting chair longer, because it's less of a, I just got hung up on 10 seconds into my pitch. It's, we both agreed that it wasn't a good time and they weren't interested. And so, okay, cool. So there's even more respect, I think, in the rejection that from, like, sales is the long game. It's a numbers game. It's like each of our callers makes 300 dials a day, 5 days a week. So, I mean, that's a monstrous amount of calls in a month. So how do you stay in the chair 7-8 hours a day? It's, I'm not getting punched in the face 150 times. It's, people are saying, no, thank you, which is very different than screw you, never call me again, et cetera. So I think there's something to be said there.
Yeah, the whole like it's people like you, and how dare you call me, and how'd you get my like, just be respectful. Here's what I'm asking for, yes or no. And you're right. It does help reduce the fatigue of making those calls. It's fascinating to hear somebody else, you know, using that kind of approach. And again, this is where for years I've said it's not B2C, it's not B2B, it's not you know, retail, it's not this, it's not that, it's H to H, right? It's human to human. And just be a human calling another human and trying to help them. That's really it.
That really is.
Yeah. All right. And so anyone listening, if you want more sales risk stuff, I have a bunch of script. Andrew, I'm sure would be open to, you know, connect with him, connect with me. There's some stuff to do in that 47 seconds or that 30 seconds. And I'm happy to chat with anyone offline about that. All right. So now let's get into the next part. So you're dealing with basically financial advisors, you're doing matchmaking with them. I love, you know, the kind of the hero's journey for you to becoming the guide, especially watching your dad go through this thing where he's trying to get out of his situation and essentially sell off his AUM book of business. And for anyone, like I had to ask Andrew early when we talked, because it's, you know, assets under management, in case anyone's curious and you didn't know, like I didn't know these terms. But so then you see him go through that and you're like, there's got to be a better way, which I always think is the best basis of starting a business, right? Where there's a problem that you're solving or you see that needs to be solved. So then what's the approach? Because I know with what you guys do, it's very much different than, let's say, the standard business broker model that's out there.
Yeah. So what we do is we first of all, from a buying side, we eliminate the marketplace. And so all of the deals that we work with are off market, meaning a buyer is one of three people introduced to a seller versus one of 30. We have a lot of buyers that come and work with us that say, you know, I've tried some of the legacy marketplaces, the 800-pound gorillas in the room that are excellent, that do a terrific job of connecting buyers and sellers. The problem is that you're one of 60 or 1,000 people that got this canned email saying, hey, Jason's business is for sale and it's in Washington and it's this much assets, you know, click here to submit a bid. It's like, okay, well, I've done that 100 times. I haven't even gotten one conversation. So for our buyers, they love working with us, because these are off market. And second of all, we're introducing them as if it's someone that we really know, because it is, right? From the sell side, we have a sales team. It's Jason, 30 seconds, you wanna, and that leads into a first kind of qualifier meeting. So tell me about the problems that we're trying to solve for. We always say we're solving for your ex. So Jason, your ex is different than Steven's ex, which is different than Robert's ex, et cetera. So we're solving for your ex. And then we have a very defined process that we take sellers, or, I mean, selling your business isn't always retiring. Maybe it's good,
good driver, bad car. Yesterday, I was on a call with a father-son team that's in the Southeast area, and father's got probably 10 years left that he wants to work. He's a great driver. He's in a bad car. So how do I get into a better vehicle? So that could look like a platform that takes more of the admin compliance off the back of, you know, off of his plate. It takes trading off of his plate and gives him the bandwidth to say, okay, everything else in the business is handled. Go grow client relationships. Go focus on serving clients more. So our process with sellers is like 4.5 hours, 4 different conversations where we're walking them through what's the value of your business. Rough ballpark numbers, right? Don't take this to the bank, but here's a range. Is my business worth 10 million or is it worth 1.8 to 2.2, right? A lot of folks have these, and I'm sure in any industry, HVAC, roofing, they hear about Johnny sold for 10 times revenue. So I get, and it's like, bro, you're regional or you're like half of a state roofer. Like you don't demand the same multiple that a nationwide company does, right? So a lot of it with the sellers is kind of taking them from the country club multiple into reality. That's the first call. Second is the legacy matchmaker. Who do you want to pass the baton to? This isn't about money most of the time. Like 8 out of 10 times, money is probably the top 4 or 5th priority. 1, 2, and 3 are usually ethics, a good fit for my clients, right? Or something that fits and allows me, the advisor, to go to the next level over the next 5 to 10 years. Yes, I want fair value for my practice. Right. Very rarely is I want top dollar number one. Those exist and everyone has, you know, they have the right to do that. But a lot of time in that legacy matchmaker conversation, it's look, my clients have gotten accustomed to X, Y, or Z, or this is my investment philosophy that they've bought into. If I sold to someone that is complete, if I'm a buy and hold Warren Buffett kind of guy and I sell to top dollar a cowboy stock picker, my clients are going to go, you know, who and what are you, did you do with Andrew, right? So it's about kind of fitting that puzzle, those puzzle pieces together on multiple areas. The third conversation is all about what's a deal that you would say yes to, structuring the deal. Do you want to get paid over, you know, 5 years and you're cool with, you know, kind of seller financing and therefore you want a little bit extra? Or hey, if my business is worth $100, I'll take 70 today versus 100 over 2 years or whatever, right? So at the end of that, we'll ask the seller or the transition, the sunsetter, Jason, would you trust us enough to make 2 or 3 introductions over the coming weeks? And at that point, they've spent 5 hours with us and they're like, of course, right? So then we're going to our buyer network and saying, okay, what fits with what Jason's looking for? He's on Schwab, they're on Schwab. He only wants to sell a minority stake. They love doing that, right? And so then we bring these conversations together. There's so much alignment because everybody's kind of fleshed out, what do I really want out of this transition? It's the complete opposite of my practice. Sale, who wants it, right? And then the seller gets 50 LOIs of people they've never met.
Yeah.
Now they're having to vet these firms and all. So it's saving a lot of people, both buyer and seller, a ton of time to be able to say, look, let's have a casual, authentic conversation with the executive team at BuyAUM. Tell them what's important to me. A lot of these, the feedback that we get from sellers is like, this was a terrific process. You guys have asked me questions I've never had to force myself to think of. Like, they're the advisor. And so a lot of times they're asking their clients, what happens if you're compromised? Do you save enough for it? And now we're asking them, Jason, what happens to your business if you're locked in a room for 60 days? What breaks? And so the result is everybody's just supernatural, not in that sense, but it's very natural. And
yeah,
a lot of times it leads to a, you know, you meet 2 or 3 firms, you pick one, you get a deal done in 5 to 6 months from the time you had a cold call.
Yeah, it's so, let's unpack all that because I think it's fascinating. So for your focus, right? So your focus on financial advisors, is the valuation process pretty straightforward with that based on assets under management, maybe a couple other factors, but is it pretty formulaic versus, let's say, a roofing company or HVAC or nail salon?
It is quite formulaic. The true value report that you can find on our website, it's completely free. It's no strings attached. That's our loss leader, very frankly, right? Everybody's like, what's my business worth? And that gets them in the door. The way that these businesses are done, and I lead our finance department, think about a ladder. In between the rungs of a ladder, there's low, medium, and high multiples. So the rungs are the amount of assets that you have. Between 50 and 75 million in AUM, 2.8, 3.1, 3.3 is usually a revenue multiple that things trade on. 75 to 100, right? And they slowly kind of go up. We bind all that data by Sika Fletcher, which aggregates all of the deals that are done over the last like 2 or 3 years. There's 26,000 deals. And so they're putting out, hey, on average, a firm that's in this range, here's the multiples that they trade on. There's revenue multiples or a revenue ladder, and there's an EBITDA ladder. You like to see, if I do, and we do both, a revenue multiple might be 3.2 times revenue. Your EBITDA multiple might be 4.6 times. We like to see the delta between those very small.
Yeah.
If it's a huge delta, either it usually tells you, this is a business with a ton of expenses. Right. Because if I'm doing an EBITDA multiple, an EBITDA valuation on a business, the number is always going to be higher than the revenue number, the multiple number, because I'm taking into account expenses. Right. So if an EBITDA valuation says this business is worth $1 million and a revenue multiple says it's worth $3 million, okay, well, then there's a ton of expenses here. Now, maybe that's personnel. Maybe it's whatever it is, right? But those are the basic ways to do evaluation. It is very structured. The True Value Report is based off of self-entered data. So we always caveat it with like, look, I've seen deals trade to the penny of the TVR. I've seen them trade much higher and much lower, right?
But yeah.
Based on AUM, average fee that you charge, households, all of that, we're able to get pretty close to, if there's nothing crazy under the hood, what's something I could expect?
Got it. And I think that it's interesting to point out, because I know from all the business brokers that I know, I've gotten to know and also talk to on the show, is that the valuation process of, let's say, I'm going to say other businesses, I was going to say standard, but like businesses outside of what you're talking about, where it's based on, you know, the AUM in your world, is that there's so much that goes into it. And it's not that it's subjective, but everyone will weight and balance and kind of calculate things maybe a little different, because there's no like set structure for how that's done. And that's usually a lengthy involved process, like lots and lots of like hours go into a very strong valuation. And the reason I point that out is because you have your four or five hour kind of meeting structure, where it doesn't sound like it's a lot of the valuation conversation or research. It's maybe resetting the expectation, like you said, the country club valuation, because they talked to a guy who sold his HVAC company for $50 million. So they should at least be able to get that for their, you know, financial services business. And so, like, you know, but it's fascinating, because then those meetings are, like you said, about investigating and asking them questions and really going deep. And I love like how, I don't want to say sales, but like how professional you guys are at it, because best thing you can do is ask questions and investigate and learn more. And it's funny you're talking about that with financial advisors, because I remember the first financial advisor I ever sat down with on his basically intake lead sheet with me was basically asking why over and over again. I think it was like 5 times. He even had it listed out on the sheet, which is the major strategy. It's like, why is that important to you? Well, I want to have $100,000 in the bank. Okay, why is that important? But why is that important to you? Why is, like, just digging deep. And it's funny, because I can imagine you turn the table on this business owner, this financial advisor, and go deep with them. And they're probably like, nobody ever asked me about
my love it.
Yeah,
they love it. We were working with a group in I think it was Kentucky or Kansas City. It was like Central America, Central U.S. Three partners. One of them's mid to late 70s. The other two guys are in their 50s.
we went through like half of the process and we basically said, congratulations. I ended this call by saying, congratulations, guys, you don't need us because you have a succession plan in place. You don't really have any pain points. We kept searching for like, what's the X we're solving for?
Yeah.
And they were like, honestly, the guy in the mid to late 70s was like, I don't want this to end because it's been so valuable. It's forced us to have conversations between the three of us that we've never had. What do you really want to get out of this? I love that, right? We don't charge sellers. We're not demanding exclusivity because at the end of the day, if we go through this process and then you realize Johnny down the street is the perfect successor for your clients, but we don't work with Johnny, like, who am I to limit you from finding the successor that really is the best fit? And so it's really authentic and transparent. And we've had a lot of success that sellers just appreciate the way that we approach stuff. And yeah, I think we are. I mean, you do something 1,000 times, you get pretty good at it. But asking the question in a respectful way that kind of pokes holes in, is that really a good plan? Like, yeah, you could go, you know, a common objection is like, good driver, bad car, right? I'm not ready to retire, but I'm doing all of these admin tasks. Okay, well, here's a firm that will, you know, you can plug into them and they'll take a 10 or 15% override on your gross revenue and they'll handle all the unfun things for you. Admin, compliance, billing, trading, whatever. And the common response is, yeah, but that scales with my revenue. I could just go out and hire somebody. And as a good friend and like one of my best buddies always says, like, how's that working out for you? And, you know, it's like, okay, well, yeah, good luck. Go hire someone, train them, pay them a base salary of 6 figures or close to it. It's, you know, all of the bells and whistles that go along with that, and then hope that they don't quit, get another job, and then you're back where you were. And so it's the respectful, like, holding the mirror up. I got married 6 years ago, and they always said that marriage is like a mirror and a spotlight and sandpaper. And that is the truest thing I've ever been told. But we kind of hold a mirror up to advisors, and we're like, is that really, like, going to work? They love it. So it's been a lot of fun. Personally, I only have one living grandparent. He goes by Grampy. He's in Cleveland. He's 91. I get a pop into guys that are 60, 75, 73 all the time. And we have these, I love it. I hear so many good stories and life lessons. It's a tremendous career job to be calling these folks and trying to serve them and help them get paid versus you wind the clock back 9 years for me. And I'm calling Jason going, hey, here's this great investment that I want you to put money into. Now I'm saying, hey, I want to get you paid. It's my happiness scale is much higher than it used to be.
I love it. And mixed in there, it's very subtle what you said, but essentially it's really from a place of abundance. And again, anyone knows me, I even had a chapter in my first book that I published called The Power of Saying No, which is that like scenario you said was like, basically what you're telling me, you don't need us. So like, I can't help you. It's not worth it. It would actually be bad of me to try to help you. And I love that because there's so much power when you tell somebody, no, like it's not a good fit. I can't help you. You don't need me. When you do say it is a good fit and you do need me and I can help you, you mean it, but it's not from a place of like everyone wins, as I refer to it. Like, you know, it's like, I'm just going to help you one way or another. And so I love that. I love that abundance approach. There's enough people out there. And what's interesting, and I have one more question about sellers before we talked about buyers, but with your model, because your goal is to serve the sellers, like the business owners, but really as a vehicle with the buyers are important. You got to keep them happy. So obviously you got to serve up, businesses that make sense to them and that's going to be a good fit and it's going to progress. Before we move on, sellers, what do you see? What's the part that maybe owners, these financial advisors you're dealing with, underestimate in the walking away from their business, no longer being involved? I'm guessing in your industry, like most others with business brokers, like there's some kind of like seller's remorse that happens during, towards the end, and after, where somebody's identity was wrapped into their business or everything that they did. You know, how do you, what do you see in that realm? How do you help coach through that, I guess? You know, how do you deal with that? If you're listening to this and thinking, I need this level of authority, I just don't have time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. That's what we do here. We build that whole thing for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and the authority signals, everything we've talked about here on the podcast. So if you want to add impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it could look like for your business. Coach through that, I guess. You know, how do you deal with that?
I'm a SEPA, and the Exit Institute did a nationwide survey, I think it was in 2024, of exited business owners, all industries, right? Not financial advisors, but all industries. Surveyed exited founders, business owners, what have you, a year after exit or sale. 70% of them regretted selling. And it was not because of the financial, oh, I sold too low or I sold too, you know, early. It was, who am I now? Mm-hmm. And what am I, like, what value do I bring to the world? It is a very real thing, especially within financial advisors, because it's such an intimate place to be. These clients have been with them for 30 years. They've gone to the bat mitzvahs, they've gone to the birthdays, the weddings, the funerals, like, these are my friends. And now, who am I? It's a huge thing. We were working with the seller last year in the Gulf Coast. He got to the LOI stage, and then he was like, you know what, guys? Like, I can't fish. He was a big fisherman. He's like, I can't fish 5 days a week. I get it. I get it. About 9 months later, we called him. Hey, how's it going, Charles? And he was like, you know what? I'm ready now. Okay. Great, right? So it has to be a timing thing. How do we combat against it? As a free gift to all of the graduates of our X-ray on the sell side, we send them, we accumulate all of this intel, and we send them a printed, it's really high end, like 30 pages bound. It's their succession blueprint. And it recaps the valuation. It recaps, it's got letters from my co-founder and I to them. And it's even got follow-up questions of like, write a letter to your successor, or a successor will be, you know, successful if he treats my clients like blank, or if he never forgets blank. The three enduring values that I want a successor to bring are X, Y, and Z. A lot of it goes into the preparation of what are you doing as a human after you sell this business. The scary thing, right? It's like, I don't think about my taxes on 4th of July. I don't want to think about that. I don't want to think about what happens when I don't wake up and look at the markets, or people don't call me when they have a question about geopolitical stuff. And so we encourage folks to like almost have a business plan for what they want to do. Oh, Jason, I really want to travel Europe. Okay. Not good enough. Where do you want to go? Well, I've never been to London. I've never been to Barcelona. Okay. How long do you want to go? What do you want to visit when you're there? Like, where's the business plan? Or I'm really involved in charity. Okay. Which charities do you want to volunteer more with? What days of the week do you want to, like, create a business plan for, as the SEPA Institute calls it, the third act, right? Yeah. Like, what are you going to do in the third act after the intermission? You golf for a couple months, you go on a trip, like, who are you now? You have to put thought into it. And so we kind of tee them up for that. Frankly, we don't have enough time to sit down, have a cup of coffee, a cigar, and go, Jason, who are you outside of work, right? But we give them a workbook to kind of continue the journey. A lot of them have really appreciated it. It's something that needs to be addressed with mental space, that because it's that, think about my taxes next year. I'm at a barbecue right now. I'll think about what I'm going to do when I retire, when that comes.
Yeah.
You get hit by a bus, you could have sickness. Like, people just avoid it because I think it's scary. And a lot of our identity in the U.S. is wrapped up in what we do for society. Mm-hmm. You layer onto that, you're in a position of great influence over clients, not in a negative way, but like, you're a trusted, it's a very intimate relationship. There has to be thought process put into who am I after I'm an advisor.
Yeah. And I think that identity piece is huge. I love the binder that you send people. I hadn't thought about it specifically, but it is, I could see it being so much more amplified in the realm of the business owners that you're working with as the financial advisors versus maybe even other businesses, because you're like, to your point, this financial advisor working with a client for 10, 20, 30 years, like my current financial advisor, I met him at a crab feed a long time ago, and he takes care of mine, my parents, like my parents, you know, they lived local. They, you know, as they were selling stuff like a trailer and an ATV, like his family now has their telescope. Like, you know, it's just, it's that kind of relationship. And I can see that, that being tough to walk away from, especially because they're usually involved in the community, a lot of networking. They're the person that everyone knows, and you're just basically, you know, moving from that. And that, I could see that being really tough. So I love how you addressed all of that. And hopefully that helps them keep going and not cancel the deals. I'm sure you have some stories of people like the guy who wanted to wait 9 months, where people just get really cold feet or stop with buyers, or does that, you guys mitigate that pretty well?
I mean, it depends, right? The last thing I want to do is force someone into something or have them think that they owe us. I mean, this is a huge, this is the biggest decision they've made in their career. Yeah. And it's like, I get it. I have a lot of sympathy for it because, you know, I'm a young man with a growing family and a business that I'm building. Like, of all of that faded, and now I'm 75 and like, what do, I get it. Like, so I, it's less about trying to avoid it and mitigate it. I think it's about addressing the things early and making sure that it is the right time, because the last thing that we want to do, or even a buyer wants to do, is buy a business and then, you know, the seller's frustrated or regretful or any of that stuff. So I think it's less about mitigating it and more about having compassion on the reality of such a dramatic change. And kind of going, hey, when you're ready, man, we're here. And
yeah,
I think that goes into why we've had more successes, because it's not about just numbers. You enter a marketplace, you get the highest bid. I think there's more propensity to regret that versus you feel really, really good. Yesterday, I was on with a guy who's in Hawaii. He's had 50 years of experience doing this. And he's met with a few buyers, didn't really have that spark. Met with one yesterday, and you could see it in his eyes where he's like, I want to move forward. It was a first call, right? First intro, buyer and seller. And he's like, I'm just thinking about moving forward because I feel like you will carry the torch well. And so it's a little bit about, we don't like to over-engineer the magic. Like, on paper, A and B should really like be a good fit, and then it's not. Like, okay.
Yeah.
So that's why every seller goes on 3 first dates. It's not one, like, you got it. I grew up in college. I met my wife. We dated for a few years in college and things got serious. I loved her. I loved her family. I'm like, I have no idea who I am. I'm a young buck. So I broke up with her, crushed her heart, moved to California, dated other people. And then so did she. And then I'm like, oh man, I'm an idiot. Like, I got to go get her back. Right? She blocked my phone number, which to any guy out there, shows that she cares. So I call her dad and, you know, figure out where she's at. And I come back to Atlanta and fight for her. It wasn't until I had the other interactions of saying, sure, that was actually really good. And so there's a seller in New Jersey and we kind of showed him 3 different firms. He's like, this one, I want a meeting with this one. I don't really know about these other 2. And I said, Steven, like, I get it. And I shared that story with him. I'm like, you know, maybe that first one is a perfect fit. how will you know that that's a perfect fit if you haven't met anyone else? So I don't remember the original question, but that's really kind of the process.
No, and it was more, the question was more about, you know, the people, the sellers who get the cold feet or don't want to move forward. And what you addressed was perfect, which is about their own timing and then them having it feel like a good fit as well with that transition, but whenever they're ready. So with your model, let's switch and let's talk about what you guys focus on, which is obviously the buyers. They say they bring three buyers in, because at no point so far have you talked about the agreement being with the seller and the seller pays you, which means it's on the buy side. So talk about that model, I guess, talk about what the, you know, is there anything specific that you're filtering the buyers for or helping the buyers find, or I'm guessing you have your way of figuring out what they each need. And so you can, you know, play the matchmaker appropriately for them.
Yeah. I mean, at its core, I want many different styles of firms. I've got some hybrids. I've got folks that are pure RIA. I got folks that are regional. I got national presence brands, right? Part of a wirehouse, you know, fully independent, anti-PE. I got some PE background, right? I want kind of like one of everything. If I asked, if you are a wealth manager in the US and you want to buy a firm, raise your hand. Everyone's hands go up, right? And so it's about kind of narrowing that down, seeing who's really ready.
Yeah.
Like our thesis is based around the movie Moneyball. Like he gets on base. If you've ever seen that movie, it's a great film. I get the misfit toys that get on base. So I love doing deals with solo firms because there's one decision maker, maybe two. I don't love the five partners. Like my dad's example, everybody's got a different desire. So like, some folks will say, oh, I've only got 35 million in AUM. Like, I'm probably too small for you. He gets on base, right? Like, there's one decision maker. So I love that. From a buy side, I need you to be experienced in doing this. I don't want to be the first time you've made an acquisition. It's too much learning curve. I need you to have financing in place. I need you to have someone dedicated to the acquisition and the growth. And we learned this the hard way with a firm that was about half a billion in AUM, but it was owner led and a very small team. And so the availability to meet with sellers, to follow up, to say, yeah, I'm going to send you that, and to actually send it to them. Like there almost needs to be a chief growth officer or a department that is around that. There are a lot of folks that are a couple hundred million in AUM. They hear about us and they're like, great, bring me deals. And I'm like, look, if I bring you one, you're going to take 6 months to chew it up and absorb it. I need like serial acquirers. And so that's one thing. The other is cheeky to say vibes, but like not everybody is a closer. And we do so much hard work to work with sellers. They say, yes, I'll trust you to make an introduction. I don't want to introduce them to a dud or someone that kind of like, gotcha. And so there's a lot of vetting that goes into the buyers that we work with. We say no probably 70% of the time. And then you find some firms that are terrific. One of our buyers is a husband-wife team, national presence. They are amazing, right? They love it. They love us. I think we've introduced 4 billion worth of off-market deals to them in 6 months. They're loving us, right? But they're the type of firm that sellers love. And so part of it is the intangible, like, are they a closer? Like, do I think that sellers that we work with would vibe with them?
Yeah.
Or they have the first date and they go, eh. Like, I've had two buyers that offer the exact same thing. Seller meets with both of them. And one's like, I don't really want to see them again. And another one's like, they sound great. I'm like, okay, you know,
yeah.
I can't really do anything about that. And so a lot of it is vetting and like the tangible things. You have financing, you've done this before, et cetera. And then there is an intangible sort of metric, the qualitative versus the quantitative that comes into making a buyer a good buyer, right? But if you're buy-in of any industry, it's about being interested and not interesting.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that we work with people that have made an acquisition before is because newbies get on the phone and they're like, let me tell you about myself and why I'm awesome. And like, the seller doesn't care, right? Be more interested, be less interesting. And it's different than, I think, for an advisor that wins clients, can be super successful at winning high net worth clients. Being successful at winning acquisitions is a different skill set. And so that's why we like to see, have you done this before? And then we'll vet them two or three times. Sometimes we'll even tee up like a one-off to kind of make sure that they have a good, before we engage with, you know, an annual commitment sort of thing.
Nice. Yeah. And I think that's important, right? Because there's the tangible and then there's the intangible. I have spent a lot of my professional career hiring, interviewing, talking to potential candidates, you know, from all the time I spent in sales. And, you know, to your point, like two people, same resume, same experience. You talk to them. And one, you realize that you ran out of time and you didn't even get close to chatting about everything because it just flew by. And another one's just like sitting across from a teenager at dinner trying to find out about their life. And it just sucks. It's just like, oh man, you know, it's those things where, you know, it's just, it's got to be a good fit. You know, everything is about relationships, right? Dating, work, what you do. And so it's all about that human connection. And is there a vibe? And do I want to introduce you to people and stake my reputation on this, right?
Yeah. I mean, if a seller spends 5 hours with us and we totally whiff, you know, the first, like you whiff the first one, they're like, all right, I'll give you one more shot. We whiff the second one.
Yeah.
You know, we're a waste of time in their mind. And so the buyers have to be a reflection of our culture and our firm and our values. And we're quite picky with who we work with, but we've got a great team roster of buyers, and we're always open to more, right? It's a numbers game from that aspect too. If I say no 7 out of 10 times, 3 out of those 10 times I'm going, this is a great fit.
Yeah, I love it. All right, so let's move on to the next portion of the show, because I'm super curious, especially because you've built and are a part of a hyper-focused niche kind of M&A world. But let's talk about the broker growth tips. So the things that come to mind when you think about marketing, growth, the strategies, you've already talked a lot. I mean, you know, everything you do with a seller is so amazing. And I think, you know, something that others can take lessons from. But when you think of like growing the practice, what are the things that come to mind?
I think part of it is getting on the same page between what a buyer and seller are looking for, which is why we take so much time to meet with sellers. A lot of times in the beginning, they don't really know what they're looking for. And that's what the x-ray process kind of uncovers, is this is important and this is not. Hey, geography actually doesn't really matter, but tech stack does. Or geography is super important, but investment philosophy doesn't. What have you, right? So aligning on those goes back to asking questions, is making the fit around before the introduction happens is super important, right? So a tip for all, you know, business brokers out there is don't just put people together because, hey, I'm looking for businesses over, you know, 2 million in EBITDA. Here's one. It's like, okay, well, is there anything else that makes that a fit, right? So that's one. I think if we had calls with sellers and just kind of let them, like a buyer could see our fee structure and say, that's crazy because I'm paying based off of transaction value and you're just going to help push all these deals as high as you could get. Well, yeah, except if down the line I make an introduction and a seller's looking for 10 million for his business and his business is worth 2, maybe 2.5. What a waste of time. And so underwriting things from a buy side, even when you're meeting with a seller, maybe they have an HVAC company and you know, I'm great at HVAC. I know the market. This is probably a $3 million business, but the guy wants 6 for it. If you let him keep thinking that, you are doing yourself a disservice. And so underwriting and kind of guiding the seller of a business into what is a reality for them is super helpful down the line. Yes, did your fee, potential fee, just go from a $6 million, a fee on $6 million versus three? Yeah, but what's the probability that you attach right. the fee? If that's a 2% probability and 3% is a 70%, right? Like that's, I think, the math that people don't take into account where, again, it goes back to the money ball. Do they get on base? Like, I want deals that get done, not necessarily these monster ones that take 2 years and probably fall apart twice.
Makes so sense. Yeah, I think it's important. Anyone who's worried about the fee stuff from somebody who's in a pay for performance model, like doesn't understand it because, you know, it's market price, the market value. It's what the market will pay. So you know, somebody could try to be greedy and jack up a price all they want, but the market will tell you if that works or not.
We have a seller that I explained to the seller, I bought a house 2 years ago. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house. It's a ranch with an unfinished basement. Yes, it could have a finished basement and a new addition put on and a nice back porch, but it doesn't. I bought a 3-2. And so like, right. yes, your business has the potential to grow.
Right.
It is what it is, right?
So like, that's it.
It's the reality check of like, I want to sell it, you know, this is a 5-3, you know, with a great backyard. It's like, it could be, but it's not. And so
right.
being, I think, an expert in your field. And that's why I think there's so many great people say the riches are in the niches. And it's like, because I know this space inside and out, like the back of my hand, I can confidently not cut someone off at the knees, but go, yeah, I wish I could dunk a basketball, but like, that's not happening. So like, yeah, I wish you could get $7 to $10 million. You're not. You're going to get maybe two and a half. So,
yeah.
but I only know that I have the confidence to say that respectfully because I know what these things trade for. I'm not trying to do CPA practices and RIAs and HVAC and roofing. And I'm just a jack of all trades, master of none. When you are a master of one and you say no to all these other things, you're able to get more deals done because you know what things trade at. You know what's important to buyers and sellers. And that nurture process along the way leads to everybody's ready to get something done on realistic terms when that perfect fit comes along. So
yeah,
I'll say it again. Everybody always says it, the niches are in the riches. I think focusing on one lane versus being an agnostic sort of broker will lead to a lot of success.
Yeah. And I firmly believe that. I think, and I've had conversations with various people on the show and off the show, and the brokers that I see that I think have the best model is the niche industry specific, to your point, being able to look at a business, look at the financials or look at the model. In your case here, it's pretty straightforward and go, this is what it's worth, or this is what you're hiding in, you know, other industries like restaurants. It's like, look at the financials. You know, I had Dominique, the restaurant broker on, and he said, it's like, look at somebody's financials and know exactly what they're trying to cover up or hide or not do right, or where the bodies are buried in the financials. And then, is this going to sell or not? Like, that's it, really quick. Versus, you know, a generalist broker would have to like figure it out and probably learn some painful lessons about restaurants and then some painful lessons about roofing right along the way. So,
yeah, I think at the end of the day, like saving wealth, like this framework of like find an industry that's growing, right? If I said, yep, I'm a broker for newspaper, you'd go, good luck. Right? That's a dying industry. So find an industry that like has action in it, that has capital in it as well, right? Hey, you know, I can't think of one right now, but like no one's spending money on newspapers and because they're dying. So our buyers are wealth advisors that have, you know, a billion in assets. So they have money to spend on acquisition. So check, right? And then save them time. Well, all of a sudden now I've created value for someone. And so they're willing to compensate me because I'm not having to be one of 60 firms that is competing for a book of business. I'm one of three and I'm not in a bidding war. It's, hey, here's, this is a great fit. And of the three, it's usually, seller usually writes one off after the first meeting. It's usually I meet with three, two make it to the second date, maybe a third date with those two. I get into due diligence and I pick one. Like that's the playbook at a very simple level. But yeah, finding an industry that is growing, that has a lot of action, and you're saving wealthy people time. I mean, that's the recipe to build a successful practice.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's great. Anything else on the growth tips? Like, I think that last one was pretty much it, but anything else on the list?
I would just say less about, like, I always say, I think a lot of entrepreneurs or salespeople spend time looking for the elevator instead of taking the stairs. Mm. Let me find the one deal. I'm an elephant hunter. I want to find the one deal that's going to set me up for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
You just do the same boring thing every day. If every week you go up one stair, after a year, you're on the fifth floor.
Yep.
Otherwise, you spent a year looking for the elevator and you're still in the basement. And so I think a lot of entrepreneurs will spend a lot of years and then the business fizzles out trying to find the elevator. You know, the one referral partner that leads to 60 new clients and each one's paying me $1,000 a month and I'm going to be at 60K a month in no time. It's like, yeah, or you could just pick up the phone and bring on one client a week for the next year. So yeah. I think there's this mentality in entrepreneurship and whether it's YouTube and like this delusion around success. So many folks are looking for the elevator that's going to be overnight success. Building a business is tremendously hard. And if you have one that works, it gets boring. That's the truth, right? Like I love my business. There are days where I'm like, oh, another x-ray call, another intro. But it's the boring businesses that are successful. And so you have to fall in love with the boring work, meaning walk up the stairs, stop looking for an elevator to take you to the promised land overnight. It's not going to happen.
I heard this line and I forget, I don't know if it was a Jim Rohn or something like that. Some off comments on a YouTube video, maybe a year or two ago. And it's seriously in my log of maybe the title for my next book, but it's no one jumps up a mountain, right? Like, You don't jump to the top of the mountain, right? Like you get there to your point, one foot in front of the other. I've hiked some reasonable mountains, not big mountains, but it's like the only way to get there. It's one foot in front of the other. And it's going to take a while. You can't just jump up. I think everyone's hoping for the helicopter ride to the top where they just drop you off. But then there's nothing in it. Like there's no value of that. Right? Because it didn't build anything or earn anything. No.
So true.
Yeah. All right. So, Andrew, we're going to stop the first part here. The next part would be the deal that got away. I know there's a bunch that we can talk about because when I brought that up to you, you're like, oh, I got stories. Don't worry. So I want to save it for the after show, and then we'll talk about the after show items and the standard questions that I ask. For people who they're listening to this, they want to connect with you, they want to find out more. Maybe they're on either side of the table when it comes to the AUM discussion and buying that. The website is buyaum.com, pretty straightforward. They can find you on LinkedIn as well, Andrew Moroli. Your email will be in the show notes. Any other things? I know you said you had the True Value, was it calculator?
True Value Report. It's on the website. I'm also happy to connect with anyone that's just entrepreneurship and they want to chat. This is like the seventh business that I've started. So I've made some mistakes that probably other people are looking to do as well. So free resource. Love to mind meld with good people. Buyaum.com. Andrew@buyaum is my email. Feel free to reach out to us.
That's perfect. Well, Andrew, thank you for being here. I'm excited in the part two after show we're in talk because we'll go on some other tangents. Hopefully it's valuable for everyone tuning in. Make sure to connect with Andrew. And I just appreciate everybody being here, tuning in, listening to this, hopefully taking some notes. I know I got a lot of value from this. I've enjoyed every single time I've talked to Andrew and I was excited to have him on because of the different things that we talk about, from sales to marketing to business to sellers to buyers. So make sure to come back for part two. And as I always say, until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show, hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.